Good morning. It's Monday on My Car Gurus. We start another week here with the Car Guru. He's here, Lenny Lawson.
Yeah, business has been good. Car business is still booming. Dealers are selling everything they got and then some. We have been fortunate at Gateway, especially with our grand opening, that we got a big surge of extra product at the dealership because of the investment in the new facility.
Mm-hmm.
And people are just, I'm so grateful that of the response that we have gotten to our new commitment to Nissan, and because our sales have almost tripled as a result. And we are seeing folks coming from pretty wide distances to come to Greenville to buy a new Nissan.
I think it was all because of the show. What do you think?
Probably. It's all you. It's your personal.
I'm going to go ahead and...
It's all about you, isn't it, Tim?
I just not paying any attention to what we talked about Friday, am I?
You know, and somebody walked... It has also shown me how a facility can have an impact on a car buyer. You know, I hired a guy many years ago that when he was working in Texas at this big car dealership, they sold cars out of a double-wide trailer. They were a Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Plymouth dealer. They had Plymouth back then.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have Ram trucks, so it was Dodge. And they would sell about 300 new vehicles a month. New vehicles.
New ones.
Total of about 650 vehicles a month. They had a horrible showroom. It was so bad, they bought a double wide and had offices. It was kind of like an office double wide.
Mm-hmm.
They had a gravel lot, and they were selling 650 cars a month off of a gravel lot.
Hmm.
Now, you would think that that would not work, you know,
right,
because people would rather buy a car. But... you know, at a nice paved lot, nice facility, and all that kind of stuff. But it worked for them. And it was, they created this image of the low price alternative that, you know, eggs are cheaper in the country. They were outside of Dallas, and people had to drive like 40 or 50 miles to get to this little town, you know, that I can't remember exactly the location. It seems like he said it was close to the Oklahoma border. I don't know how close that is to Dallas. Maybe it's further.
Yeah, a little further.
Okay, but anyway, just killed it for many, many years. The dealer wore flip-flops to work, shorts, and a Hawaiian shirt every day, and he had a straw hat.
Wow.
And he walked around, and that was the image of the store, and it worked fine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here we are. You know, you go to the other end of the spectrum, we've got this big, fancy, beautiful showroom that, you know, looks like it needs to be in New York or someplace like that. And that also has an impact. I mean, we're seeing folks come in and they say, wow, this is really nice. I mean, I had no idea there was a Nissan dealer in Greenville, Tennessee, you know, and it, you just get this response. And of course, I've engineered things over a lot of years to be able to be competitive. I am a single point dealer, almost a dinosaur. Whereas, you know, I do have two very good brands, and I'm very grateful to have both Ford and Nissan. It's one of the few Ford Nissan dealers in the southeastern United States that have them both on the same
yeah,
lot. So
right.
I feel very fortunate to have that. But over the years, I've engineered things so that, you know, we could compete with much larger dealers. You know, a lot of people think, Tim, that the bigger you are, the cheaper you can buy cars from the factory, right? I mean, everything else is that way, right?
Stands to reason, volume, you know.
If you buy in bulk, if one dealer, you know, if somebody buys, you know, 10 trailer loads of toilet paper, he ought to be able to buy it probably a little bit cheaper than a guy who buys one trailer load of toilet paper.
Right.
Well, many, many years ago, the industry, the people who planned the car business and state franchise laws were enacted to protect the small guy from the big guy.
Mm-hmm.
So every dealer pays the same for their cars. Matter of fact, every dealer in this country pays the same transportation fee. You could be right next door to the plant. You're still paying $8.95 to get your Malibu to your lot. Okay, it's the same rate that the guy in Florida that's, you know, 1,500 miles from the factory. All of those are negotiated, and it's the same. So what all dealers pay for their cars are the same. Now, will one dealer sell a car cheaper than another? Yes. So much of that depends on the customer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a negotiation business. I'd rather it not be. It would be easier, far easier, if people just came and said, how much is this car? Well, it's right there on the window sticker.
Okay, there you go.
That would be easy. But, you know, after World War II, probably starting in around 47, 48, there was such a dramatic lack, I guess, of vehicles availability. And a lot of the vehicles that were coming out in the late 40s were really designed in the late 30s, you know, because the war just stopped everything from a design and production standpoint. You know, they didn't even manufacture any cars except for military use during the war. So after the war, they had all this tooling and everything, and they say, well, okay, we got to get this thing fired back up again. But when the 50s came around, then the demand just went out the roof. And so everybody was paying retail price. You know, you could not buy anything for less than sticker price. And then that started to change. Once the supply got up and was more than enough to take care of the demand, that's when negotiation started. And that's when... and really, the people say, well, when did rebates start? A lot of people thought rebate, factory rebates started in the 70s, but they actually started in the 50s in certain examples. When manufacturers had a hard time, you know, a lot of inventory sitting on dealer lots, they would you know, put a $350 rebate on a Bel Air or something like that in order to help it move. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this business is a negotiation business. And the ability of somebody to get a deal sometimes is their willingness to draw a line and hold that line up to a point. It's a lot easier when you're dealing with a dealer who doesn't play a bunch of games. You know, if I, for example, if I'm selling you a an Impala, and the dealer down the road is also trying to earn your business on an Impala. Now, on my Impala, I've got an extra sticker beside the sticker that inflates the price of the car. So it might say market value adjustment or something like that. But it's just extra margin that I've decided as a dealer to do that. Is that legal to do that is the question. Is it legal for me as a dealer to mark up a car over the manufacturer's suggested retail price?
Yeah.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
A lot of people say, well, no, that shouldn't be illegal. But I mean, shouldn't be illegal, but it is legal. Is it ethical? You know, I mean, if I'm selling oranges at a fruit stand, right? Mm-hmm. I can price them whatever I want to.
Yeah.
You know, it depends on how far I am from the source or how, if my fruit stand down the road is out of oranges, right? If he's out of oranges, then I can maybe charge more for my oranges. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, everything is that way. But with cars, you know, we're talking about significant investment. The reason a lot of this shenanigans happen is because there's so little margin left in a new car anymore. We're dealing with anywhere from 6 to 7% profit margin. In 1971, when my dad bought the Chevy dealership in Greenville, we had 18% margin on a just most Chevrolets had 21% margin on a Corvette.
Yeah.
And so as the margin has shrunk, dealers have had to get creative as to how they're going to make additional money. That was when really as margins started to shrink, that was when dock fees started happening, you know, documentary fees, processing fees and stuff like that. I mean, our first processing fee was, I think, $29, you know. And now you see, you know, you'll see $700, $800, $900 processing fees in Knoxville and bigger dealerships.
Yeah.
But that people say, well, what is that? What is the documentary fee? What is the processing fee? And then that's when you get some of the dealers will say, oh, well, that's for all of the financing and all the paperwork that we do and stuff like that, almost like they're doing a mortgage on a home. But in fact, it's just profit. It's margin that they have had to give up over the years. And so everything's negotiable. And so the average consumer has the ability to do that if they are prepared and understand what they're dealing with. But, you know, over the years, there have been cars that have just sold like hotcakes that you can actually charge more than the window sticker for right now. That can happen on the Ford Bronco. Now, Ford is trying to control that, but there are dealers that are saying that, you know, they'll sell you a Ford Bronco for $10,000 or $15,000 over the window sticker. There was a dealer in a Ford dealer somewhere in California that was charging $5,000 over sticker for the new Mach-E Mustang. Well, Ford slapped that down because they didn't want that to tarnish the image of the car. But there are other cars that needed a little help to get rid of, and we'll talk about them. We're going to talk about the absolute worst cars in America ever right after the break.
We're back. It's My Car Guru for this Monday morning with Lenny Lawson. You say the worst cars, marketed cars ever? Is that what you
in America?
In America.
Yeah. I mean, what cars come to mind for you? And you better not say my favorite, one of my favorites. But go ahead. I dare you.
Is one of your favorites the Edsel?
No. But the Edsel was not a terrible car. It was just a terrible execution and a marketing problem.
That's the one that comes to my mind.
That's the one that does come to everybody's mind. You know where the Edsel name came from?
From Henry Ford's, the second's, or Henry
his
Ford's son.
Yeah,
not the it, second.
His only
The
son.
Second was actually the grandson.
It was the grandson, right. But Edsel was basically an attempt to come up with a sub-brand. You know, we were talking yesterday about sub-brands, like the Bronco and the Bronco Sport and the coming Bronco truck and things like that, where the Ford Motor Company has, you know, additional models that become a brand in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. Well, the Edsel was an attempt at that. You know, they had the Ford, they had Lincoln, they had Mercury, and then they were going to come out with the Edsel.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and it was a miserable failure. But it is... ranked as probably one of the biggest failures of all time. Now, one that didn't make the list that I was glad because it would have been offensive to me was the Corvair, because I love Corvairs.
Yeah.
The Corvair was not a miserable car, but, you know, Ralph Nader made it famous by, in his book, Unsafe at Any Speed, which they proved several years later that the Corvair was not an unsafe car. People just didn't know how to inflate the tires properly. They weren't following the instructions. And it did have live swing axles in the back in its first 4 years that were kind of like a Volkswagen and difficult to handle if you didn't have your, you know, if you didn't have your weight distribution right and you didn't have your air pressures right. 65, they fixed all that and turned it into quite a car. But by then, the handwriting was on the wall.
I would say the Corvair manufacturers, Ralph Nader wasn't one of their favorite people for sure.
No, he was not. I think they put a hit out on him. Oh, number nine. So number 10 is the Edsel. Okay. Number nine, we're going in reverse order.
Okay.
Chrysler decided to take some... You remember the LeBaron?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this was a sporty car. Well, Chrysler decided we need something even sportier. We need something that has an Italian flair. So they hooked up with Maserati.
Mm-hmm.
That's an Italian company.
Mm-hmm.
And they got Maserati to build these bodies in Italy and then ship them to the United States, and they came out with the Chrysler TC by Maserati. Look at that little opera window back there. Well, it was Lee Iacocca had a very friendly relationship with Alejandro De Tomaso, the owner of the magnificent Pantera, and at the time the De Tomaso family also owned Maserati, so Lee Iacocca had an idea to take a Chrysler product and combine it with a beautiful Italian-designed Maserati body. It didn't work, and it was one of the worst American debacles or American cars ever made.
Mm-hmm.
Number eight. I hate to see a Ford Mustang on the list, but here's one. It was called the Mustang II. You know, in 1964, it was a historic year for the Ford Motor Company. It actually made that entire decade. The 60s was a home run for Ford. But then this little thing called the oil crisis struck the U.S. in 1973, and it forced Ford to change the Mustang formula, get away from these V8 engines and stuff, and slap a little... create this thing called the Mustang II, which is actually based on the Pinto. It had a base engine that was a four-cylinder, and that really was a problem, and it didn't sell. And it really almost destroyed the Mustang. There was actually a point at the end of the Mustang II that they said, maybe we just don't need to have the Mustang anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But they came out with the Fox Body Mustang, and they resurrected the brand, so it's been good. Another one that I remember, you remember the Chevy Cavalier, you know, when it came out. Mm-hmm. It was the, next to the Chevette, it was, which was another crappy car, the Cavalier was, you know, I mean, I drove them, and they were good handling cars and stuff. They just weren't very well made. We had a lot of issues with them.
What was the first year for the Cavalier? Early 80s, wasn't it?
Yeah, 83 or 82, 80, I think, was the first year.
Yeah.
Well, then Cadillac wanted to get in the game. Cadillac was struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, well, you think we could take this little Cavalier and turn it into a luxury car? Mm-hmm. Well, they tried, and it was called the Cimarron.
Mm-hmm.
And they were trying to do something. You know, of course, Cadillac's main competitor was Lincoln. And then they decided to take the Cavalier and turn it into a Cadillac with fancy wheel covers and thickly padded leather seats and a fancier dash, and it was a miserable failure.
I remember them coming down the road, and the difference between the Cavalier and the Cimarron was the fancy wheel.
It had different tail lights, but very similar. I mean, from a distance, that's a Cavalier. I'm showing Timmy a picture.
I remember when they would come down the road, and you'd think, well, there's a Cavalier, but no, it's a Cadillac. And I said, that's a Cadillac?
Yeah.
Oh, it's got fancy wheels on it.
This next car in the late 70s, you know, the gas crisis was still very much present, and it was prompting U.S. automakers to heavily compromise and ruin some of their models and forcing customers to switch to more fuel-efficient things, which was a problem. I lived through that. Oldsmobile said, well, we've got this great-selling car called the Cutlass.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody must have said, well, let's see what we can do to ruin that. Well, they did their best, and they put a diesel engine into a Cutlass. You know, usually diesels were reserved for pickup trucks and commercial vehicles. In European markets, you know, diesel power was the thing. You think about all the Mercedes and stuff like that. But Oldsmobile tried to make their own diesel engine, and they tried to convert a gasoline engine into a diesel power plant, and all it resulted for them was a bunch of lawsuits and a bad, big stain on their reputation. So the diesel Oldsmobile is on this list of some of the worst American cars. We already mentioned the stablemate of this next car, which was the Mustang II. But the Pinto is a regular guest on just about every worst car list you have ever seen. It was not pretty. It was another byproduct of the post-gas crisis in America. It was designed to be affordable. You could buy one. I remember seeing ads for 1995. We had the Chevy Vega. You know, it's interesting that the Vega isn't on this list.
Yeah.
Because I always thought the Vega was a better car. Now, they did have a problem with the aluminum block, you know, and they solved it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was too late. It was one of those things, it's too little, too late.
Mm-hmm.
But the Vegas, you know, would blow head gaskets. And I think it was a better-looking car. I think most people would agree.
It was. I remember a lot of them rusting, having rust issues.
Now, you didn't have to bring that up. You know, all cars from that era rusted.
Yeah.
I mean, they all do. I mean, the Bronco that I have right now, they were rust buckets. Number three on the list is an interesting family of vehicles. It was another post-gas crisis, another attempt at a domestic automaker, a failing domestic automaker, to produce a car that would be something that would sell, and it was called the AMC Pacer, and it was introduced as the world's first wide small car.
Mm.
And there's a reason no one else ever tried to do that since. At first, Pacer was supposed to be powered by a rotary engine and was developed with General Motors, believe it or not, but there were problems with the Pacer from the moment it started. I mean, lots of issues. The engine was no good. The body was no good. And it ended up being a miserable failure for AMC.
Too much glass.
Yeah, a lot of glass.
Do you remember the prominent movie the Pacer was featured in?
Oh, yeah, Cars. The Cars movie.
Yeah, that. But I'm talking about an older movie.
No.
Wayne's World.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah, Wayne's World.
Okay.
Yeah, Wayne drove a Pacer.
Well, yeah. Son of a gun. I didn't know that.
Did you give us number one? You haven't yet, have you?
No, I haven't got there yet.
Okay. Well, we're going to take our last break, and we'll come back and reveal number one. We're back here as we wrap up My Car Guru for this Monday morning, a very interesting list of the worst cars marketed over the years.
Yeah, the second worst car from the top is the Saturn Ion. Do you remember Saturn, right?
Mm-hmm.
We had a Saturn dealership in the Tri-Cities. Bill Gatton had it.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, they sold a lot of cars and made a lot of money on those cars. It was different, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they had plastic bodies and very economical. They came out with some little crossovers later on. But towards the end of the reign, Saturn created something called the Ion, and it didn't have a center console right in front of the driver. They moved it to the center of the dash, and nobody likes that. Nobody.
Yeah.
Maybe Tesla drivers do, but Saturn was ended up being unsupported by General Motors. They got tired of it. It wasn't working towards the end, and they eliminated it. But really, the worst car they ever made was the Saturn Ion, and it's recognized here. But, you know, leave it to General Motors to have so many of the top worst cars, and the absolute worst on a lot of people's radar was called the Pontiac Aztec. Now, this General Motors never built a good minivan, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they had the Chevy Venture, or the Lumina APV, I remember the first one, but the Chevy Venture, the Oldsmobile Silhouette, the Buick, I can't remember what the Buick was called. The Pontiac was called the Montana.
Mm-hmm.
Well, dealers were craving for some type of a sporty something, and so they decided, some brilliant engineer decided to turn a Montana minivan into an SUV, and it just didn't work. And many credit the BMW X6 as being the first ever coupe SUV. Some even say that Acura did it first, but Both of those were beaten to the punch by the Pontiac Aztec, which came out in 2001 and is considered to possibly be the absolute worst car ever made in the United States.
There you go. You know what's scary about that list is I had a couple of the cars on that list.
You liked them!
The Pinto and the Cavalier.
Bless your heart.
I had those. Anyway, that'll do it for My Car Guru on this Monday morning, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.